Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, broadcasting live from WBUR City Space. Why do people go to therapists? Lori Gottlieb knows a lot about that question, not only because she is a therapist, but also because she's been in therapy herself. Gottlieb has a new book out about this, and she's here to tell us more. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I found it not all that surprising that therapists see therapists. I think that's part of your training, isn't it?
So we do go to therapists as part of our training because we have to know what the experience is like for right. the patient. But we also go just because we're people and we have struggles too.
Is it different when therapists see therapists, would you say?
I think it is. There's a tendency, I think, to sort of backseat drive, you know, to say, you know, I wouldn't do it that way.
Right, right.
But I think also you're a person in that room. And I had the same reaction to my therapist that I think my patients have to me, which is that I wanted him to like me. If I saw another patient in the waiting room, I wondered, you know, is her session more interesting than mine?
When I read in the book, at one point you wrote that you were thinking that you wanted to reveal something to your therapist, but you were thinking, should I say that? How would I react if one of my patients said that? So I wonder if that almost can get in your way in a therapy session, being a therapist and thinking, not being able to differentiate between being clinician and being patient sometimes.
Yeah, I think you really have to just be a person in the room and take your therapist hat off.
Yeah. You do write about establishing a bond with your therapist, who you start to see after you break up with a man who you thought you were going to marry, and it's an awful breakup. And you say that what got you to see a therapist was what you called a presenting problem. But that's not always the reason why people go to therapy, really. Can you explain that, right? Am I saying that
yeah,
right?
Okay. That's right. Yeah. People come to therapy for usually a specific reason, but usually that's just kind of a red herring. So the reason that they come in, whether it's a breakup or, you know, some relational problem or whatever might be going on, is usually there's something underneath that got them there in the first place. So I always say that I'm listening not just to the lyrics, but to the music under the lyrics. I want to hear sort of what is the struggle underneath.
You wrote a little bit about this, and this is in your book. I'm wondering if you could read that excerpt for us.
Sure. So here I'm talking about my therapist and his reaction to the presenting problem. He knows that most people are brilliant at finding ways to filter out the things that they don't want to look at using distractions or defenses to keep threatening feelings at bay. He knows that pushing aside emotions only makes them stronger, but that before he goes in and destroys somebody's defense, whether that defense is obsessing over another person or pretending not to see what's in plain sight, he needs to help the patient replace the defense with something else so that he doesn't leave the person raw and exposed with no protection whatsoever.
So you go in, your presenting problem is a breakup, but what was your real reason?
I think the real reason was that he says to me in the first session, I don't think you're just grieving this breakup. I think you're grieving something bigger. And I was really going through this midpoint in my life where I was looking for more meaning and I was trying to sort of assess what it was that I wanted once my sort of the future that I had imagined had fallen apart.
And did he help you do that?
He did help me do that, although I was not necessarily on board at the beginning. And I think that that happens a lot when people come to therapy, is that a therapist will hold up a mirror to you and show you your reflection so that you can see the ways that you're shooting yourself in the foot and ending up in the same place over and over. But sometimes we don't necessarily want to see that reflection at first.
Right. It sounds like it could take a long time, too.
It doesn't always. I think there's this misconception that once you come to therapy, you're sort of stuck there for years. And that's not really what we want for people. We want them to be independent, and we want to help them get through their struggles as quickly as possible.
How do you get people to trust you enough to be able to let you get them to a vulnerable spot so they can do some of those, make some of those changes and examine themselves honestly?
Right. I think partly they have to be ready to change. So I think people who come to therapy and think that the therapist is going to fix their problems need to know that they need to make changes out in the world. But in terms of establishing the bond, I think that you have to be real and honest and human in the room with the person.
Hmm. And so then how do you peel back the layers, too, and make sure that folks who have something, especially something that might be painful that they don't want to talk about it in a gentle way so you're not overwhelming them and also helping them address it at the same time?
I think that a lot of people come into therapy with secrets, and there are the secrets that they keep from the world, and there are the secrets that they keep from the people close to them, but there are also the secrets that they keep from their therapist, and then there are the secrets they keep from themselves. And we're really working with the secrets that they're keeping from us and the secrets that they're keeping from themselves. And you can't just go in there and kind of expose people to something that they're not ready for. So I think you... you kind of come in through the back door. You kind of plant seeds along the way so that they'll be ready to talk about it later. It's almost like I used to compete in chess, and it's a little bit like that where you're thinking sort of five moves ahead.
You know, you start the book with, I would say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, a difficult patient named John.
Yes.
And you're struggling to have compassion for John. He's got some difficulties and some difficult personality things going on. What do you do in a situation like that when you have a difficult patient? And when does it get to a point, if ever, you sort of have to end it with the cleave, to terminate therapy with this client because maybe it's not going to work?
Yeah. John was this incredibly abrasive person. The first thing that he says to me is that he chose me because I was a nobody, so he wouldn't run into any of his Hollywood producer colleagues in my waiting room. And then he goes on to tell me that he doesn't want his wife to know that he's in therapy, so he hands me this wad of cash and says, I'll be just like his mistress. So he wasn't the most charming guy to begin with. But what I think the ways that people behave are their ways of managing. It's their ways of coping with the unspeakable for them. And John ends up, I think, in the book becoming the person that people end up liking the most. And he's somebody that I came to really feel genuine affection for. Because when you see the trauma and the tragedy underneath, you really start to, it draws you in and you really start to connect with him and you see what made him act that way in the first place.
Mm. And what about, does it ever get to the point where you say, you know, this person's just too abrasive and it's not going to work? Do you have to end it with a and it may yeah. this be a personality issue or not
right.
being able to connect. Does it happen, and how do you deal with that?
Rarely, but it does happen. In the book, I talk about somebody that I did terminate therapy with. She found me very unhelpful, and I felt really helpless, and I spoke to colleagues about it. I went to consultation group and tried to get feedback, but whatever anybody's suggestions were, she rejected, and I felt like I was wasting her time, and yet she didn't want to leave. She would tell me how incompetent I was, but still wanted to stay, and I would try to talk about that with her, but I just couldn't get through, and I feel like that was my failure. I feel like I didn't want to waste her time, but I did terminate. But I still feel like I wish that I had found a way to reach her. Hmm.
You write about a patient of yours in the book who's an older woman, and she really wants to change her life in a year, or she may do something drastic. And you say that it's difficult for older adults to get mental health services. Can you expand on that a little bit? Why is that, and what should older adults do?
I think older adults tend to be often more isolated. I think that they have different ideas culturally about what therapy is, and maybe there's more stigma for them, so they don't necessarily come to therapy. Often if they're retired, they might not have the means to come to therapy, and so they end up going to clinics where there are, you know, the 20-somethings who are training, and I think it's very hard for somebody who's 70 to relate to somebody who's 20 in the same way. They haven't lived enough life yet. And so I think there are a lot of barriers for older adults, and they're dealing with a lot of issues that other people aren't yet. So a lot of their friends are dying. They're dealing with their own health issues. There's a lot of loss as you get older. And also, there's a lot that has already happened in their lives. So the window for the future is shorter. And in terms of what you can change, I think that the picture sometimes looks different. But what was beautiful about that story was she was 69 years old and she had made quite a mess of her life. Her adult children didn't talk to her. She'd had a few marriages. She was incredibly isolated. And she made tremendous changes, even more than I think, you know, anybody had anticipated in that year. So I feel like it's never too late to change.
Mm. You also write a beautiful story about Julie, who's one of your patients who's diagnosed with cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about Julie, too?
Julie was in her early 30s and had just gotten married, and she felt something in her breast on her honeymoon and came back, and it was discovered that it was breast cancer. And it was a very treatable form of breast cancer, and she came to me to kind of help cope with the treatment as she was newly married. And she went through treatment. It seemed to be fine. And 6 months later, she had a very aggressive form of cancer, and she got a terminal diagnosis. And she asked me to stay with her until she died. And I had never done anything like that. And I wasn't sure I was the right person to do that because she was only going to get one chance at this. And I wanted her to have the best possible care. But she really wanted me because she didn't want to be part of what she called sort of the pink ribbons and the optimism and the affirmation world was not the approach that she wanted. And we went through that experience together of helping her to come to terms with her death.
Hmm. What did you take from that?
It made me very aware of my mortality. And I think that it's good in a certain way to be aware of it because I think that you live more intentionally. I think that you don't put things off for the future that you ordinarily think you have this long time horizon to do. Julie would always say, all of the people around who would plan, they would say things like, in 3 years we're going to buy a house, or I'm going to apply for a new job in a few years, or, you know, all these things that people would do later. And she said, you know, you don't need a diagnosis of cancer to know that you might not have later, that now is now.
Mm. Yeah. You write that the future is as much of a factor in therapy as the past.
It is. I think that the past is a fixture of therapy in the sense that we want to understand our past so that it doesn't trap us. And then how can we write a different next chapter? But I think that people focus on the past and the present a lot. But when your present falls apart, like in my case, this idea that I was going to have a future with this person, and I wasn't, all of a sudden, it wasn't just that I was missing him in the present, it was that I was missing the future that now was not going to happen. Mm. And I think that happens with grief of all kinds. When people have a miscarriage or somebody close to them dies, they're not just missing them in the day-to-day, they're missing all of the future that they would have had with that person.
I wonder, you know, you mentioned that it might be difficult for older adults to relate to some folks who are younger. And also in your book, you write about an older therapist colleague of yours, a 7-year-old man who was counseling a younger woman who wanted to know about, you know, raising children and becoming pregnant. And he thought, maybe I'm not the best person to give her advice about what's going on in the world right now. I wonder, what are some of your main pieces of advice to people in trying to find a therapist that they could connect with?
So research shows that more than a therapist's training or their years of experience or the modality that they're using, the most important factor in the success of someone's therapy is the relationship with the therapist. It's very important that people find the right therapist. So most therapists structure the first session as a consultation where it's a chance for somebody to come in and get a feel for what it's like to be in a room with that therapist. And I think the questions to ask yourself at the end of that session are, did I feel understood? Did I feel like I could talk to this person? And if you felt that way, then you should go back.
All right. Lori Gottlieb, psychotherapist, author of the new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.